The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Hey, buy in May and, well, let's stay. Market concentration getting more concentrated. Eco reports, well, they're looking kind of fresh. Good stuff out there. And we're looking into the ratchet trade with our guest today, IBKR's chief market strategist, Steve Sosnick. All this and much more on episode number 976 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And hello and welcome to this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We're here in the middle of, the start of April, let's start again. We're in the start of June. I don't know where I was thinking, but we are in June now, almost halfway through the year, which is pretty amazing considering all the things that have gone on. Markets are up and doing really well against the odds. The fact of the matter is that when we look at what's happened this year, you got to wonder, how is that possible? Well, we'll get to the bottom of some of that with our great guest today. Looking forward to speaking with him. In the meantime, I'm Andrew Horowitz, and I am the host of this show we know as The Disciplined Investor, where we spend our time each and every week trying to figure out how best we can get towards that area of, well, nirvana financially, financial security, financial independence, and making sure that we get there in a steady way and in a way that makes sense to all of us. So hopefully you're learning, you're knowing more about what happens in the markets each and every day that you are looking at things and you're doing the right things by making the decisions that the future you will look back on the current you and say, you know what? That was a smart person right there doing what needs to be done to make sure that me and my family are taken care of. Now, I hope that you're doing things that are smart. I hope you're doing things that are wise tax-wise, investing in your 401ks, making sure that you're not in a target allocation fund necessarily, that you're spending your time diversifying, as we talk about quite often, in areas of the markets that make the most sense. And that's an important thing. It's not always easy, but it's important. Spending a little bit of time, whether it's maybe even once a month, looking at what it is that you have in your portfolio, and if in fact it's the right thing that fits not only for the current times from an investment standpoint, but also, and more importantly, for you, for your risk tolerance and your time horizon. Those are the key elements of what it takes to put together a proper financial plan. And we talked about that before. We talked about our flower garden, our one foot in, one foot out. We talked about the lobster trap mentality. We have talked about so many different ways for you to orient yourself and understand better, to kind of take all the jargon out of what you hear on other shows and really try to put it in a way that's understandable and gives you confidence that what you are doing is right for you. So that's kind of a backdrop of what we do here on the show. And when we talk about things that are going on in the markets today, it's not necessarily to get anybody to make instantaneous moves or changes in what they're doing, but what it's all about is making sure that you're educated. When we talk about the economics, we talk about the earnings, we talk about things like how the impact of the war, the oil prices, what's happening there is going to affect various things. We talk about consumer sentiment. All those things are put into a giant pile. The riddle that is formed and then the answer that comes out of it is all about making sure that you're educated and can make proper decisions for the long haul, not for the short haul, not for tomorrow, not for the next day, but for many years to come. What I want to do today is I want to spend a lot more time with our guest because he is a key individual when it comes to understanding what's going on with markets, investments, behavior, and all areas and aspects of what's happening. But more importantly, he's someone who is actually day-to-day doing it. He's on it. He's writing, he's researching, His name is Steve Sosnick. He's the chief strategist at Interactive Brokers. He also serves as head trader at IBKR Security Services, which is the firm's trading division, which was formerly known as Timber Hill, by the way. He's a member of Interactive Brokers Group, and he's part of the firm's holding company. Now, he's served numerous roles in the organizations since joining Timber Hill in 1995 as the equity risk manager and as an options market maker. He led the team firm in Canada in 1998, managed Timber Hill Canada throughout its existence. And much of Steve's career was spent quietly developing and implementing algorithmic and electronic trading strategies for stocks and options before moving into a more visible role as chief option strategist and later now chief strategist. He's been all over. You've seen him on Bloomberg and Redman Barron's. He's been on CNBC. He's been everywhere. So I thought this was going to be a great opportunity for all of us to find the wisdom and understand and have the wisdom imparted to us from someone who lives it, breathes it, and does it on a daily basis. Let's get right into it. So Steve Sosnick, it's wonderful to have you on. Chief Strategist for Interactive Brokers. I really appreciate you spending some time with us today.
My pleasure, Andrew. It's great to be here.
So I have a lot of questions. I have a long laundry list of things I want to talk about. So I thought we would warm it up and warm the discussion up with a kind of a discussion of your background, how you got here, why you do what you do, and how you deal with the markets on a daily basis. So you've lived through some wild markets, right? You've been doing this for a while. This isn't something you just started last year. I wanted to kind of go back and maybe ask you, what are some of the things and times maybe over your career that really stood out to you and in terms of markets or times?
Well, it depends how far back you want to go. In August of 1982, I was a summer intern at a firm called L.F. Rothschild, Unterberg Tobin, which no longer exists.
The name was well too long.
Yeah, partly. but they, but what was fascinating then was I happened to be there when Volcker basically said, we're no longer restricting monetary policy. And I just remember the place exploding. And that was one of the most explosive moves higher that anyone's ever witnessed. Between finishing school and graduate school and some other stuff, one of my first professional experiences, once I finally, I realized I liked the trading floors, and was working at Salomon Brothers at the time. So shortly after I'd gotten my own book, I was greeted with the crash of 87. So then I saw, 5 years later, pretty much, the end of that euphoria come in a very nasty way. Obviously, since then, there have been a lot of other ups, downs, sideways. I've been with, I joined Interactive Brokers a little over 30 years ago, the predecessor firm, Timber Hill, which was an options market making firm. Not all that big at the time. Within a few years, we'd actually been the largest, we became the largest options market making firm, and I had a role in managing the risk and managing the positions on those books. But as we became more customer focused, started to branch out, realized I liked writing about markets, talking about markets, being interviewed about markets. And so here I sit, more as a talking head, but with a long background in proprietary and customer-based trading.
So that was a great time. So 82. So I think it's fascinating that we pay such attention to the Fed. Why? It took me a long time to really get this into this thick skull of mine, is that they have all the money. I mean, that's basically it, right? They can, even though they may not be right, even though they may not do what they say they're doing necessarily, just the notion of it is that they have all the money.
Well, I mean, I just gave you two examples of the Fed completely influencing the market. Number one was, Volcker had been running a regime of higher interest rates to knock out the 70s inflation, which is, it's quite understandable why he did that.
Right.
And it was quite also understandable why the market reacted so violently to the upside after, essentially 4 to 5 years of extreme monetary repression, which the Fed could do.
Right.
Also, 1987, the Fed, that was the birth of the Fed put. People don't realize that. But it was born during the crash of 87. And it's not born, it was not, neither of these measures, by the way, was done to help the stock market. Although certainly the Fed put was born out of the stock market crash. It wasn't because stocks were going down. It's because the banking system was having trouble as the result of stocks going down, because you had, you know, you had various trading firms that were probably unable to meet obligations. And in a 5-day settlement window that you had at that time, it was going to take a long time for the dust to settle. And the Fed basically said, we will provide whatever liquidity we need. And they, I happened to be on the trading floor when they stepped in and basically backstopped major firms such as definitely Salomon. I'm pretty sure it was Goldman and Morgan Stanley at the time as well. Backstop them to basically put a tourniquet on the market that was crashing, not on the Black Monday, but on the next day, which was actually worse than the crash. But because again, they, you know, there were the panic was ending, market turned around and came off its lows. So it's not remembered as being as bad of a day, but that's when the Fed intervened. But again, they intervened in the stock market, but it was not to protect the stock market. It was to protect the clearing system that was being threatened by the stock market crash.
I remember.
So, yes, they're the big dogs, and they are.
Do you remember where you were for these different events? In 87, I was just starting my career, by the way. And I remember being there, and I'm like, I don't get it. Like, you know, it was like this, it was just happening so fast. And I was just beginning to get involved in the financial services industry. And it was like, everybody's freaking out. And I didn't have a lot of money to talk about being invested inappropriately appropriately at the time. So I didn't either make money or lose money on it. So it didn't matter to me, right? That was the glorious part of that. But the lesson was very clear and ingrained in my head. And we had other things, right? You know, you fast forward to the 2008 financial crisis, which again was a backstop by the government on all this. And then the COVID crash of 2020 was a little bit different, but similar feel. And then we had Volmageddon, we had the flash crashes, we had taper tantrums, right? We had all these different things. So I guess I'll ask you this. How much then in your career are you influenced by the idea that the government is in fact extraordinarily, very much involved in what goes on? I mean, how much of on a daily basis is the government overlay part and parcel of the markets?
Well, you know, bearing in mind that the Fed is an independent institution, but if we want to think of them as governmental, they're Fed and global central banks are critical, because what is the main ingredient to financial markets? Money. Who controls the price of that key ingredient? The central banks, right? By their interest rate policy. So, if you think of the financial industry having a raw material, you know, there's basically two more raw materials, money and people. They don't control the people, but they do control the money, and they control the cost of how much. And so they control the cost of the main raw ingredient for the financial system. So, yeah, of course, you know, if you think, you know, right now we're all up in arms about, you know, the price of oil because of the situation in the Gulf. Mm-hmm. Right. But if you think, you know, so the main ingredient to the energy industry is under some price pressure. If you think about the financial industry in those terms, if the Fed lowers the price, and I'm just going to use the Fed, but it applies to ECB, it applies to Bank of Japan, it applies to global central banks.
Right.
If the price of that input gets cheaper, meaning that it's more plentiful and has lower cost associated with it, meaning interest rates, then that's generally good for that industry. If the price goes up or the quantity is constrained, that's generally not good for this industry. What we're seeing now is a little bit different, because we're basically seeing the market telling us that they don't care that the Fed might have moved toward a regime of tightening rather than a regime of easing. And for the first time in quite some time, markets are telling you, we don't care.
But markets don't seem to care about anything right now, do they?
Oh, no, there's a ton of nihilism. To be fair, they do care. They do care about earnings and guidance. And I will say that we have seen a a huge string of earnings and guidance come through since April. April earnings season was phenomenally well received, and it's and the stragglers
and they should have been, I mean, it was pretty amazing.
Yes. Now, to be fair, we were already markets were already pricing in about 10 or 11% earnings growth. They got, call it 14, 15, which is good. I'm not sure that it, you know, I'm not sure that it's slingshot rocket ship good. And I do get concerned that some of the guidance that we hear about is being extrapolated. You know, they're telling us to expect good guidance for the next quarter or two, which is wonderful. Let me stipulate. Sure. That's what we want to hear. But I do get the sense that markets are a little too willing to extrapolate one or two quarters worth of good guidance into 3 to 5 years worth of good guidance. And that's I think that's why you're seeing, you know, stocks, you know, you'd get good guidance from some of these companies in the past and they would go up 5-10% after earnings. Now you're seeing 20-25%, 30% routinely, which is telling me that it's not just a cold calculation at the back, you know, back of the envelope spreadsheet type of calculation. There's an emotional component, or there's just sort of an over extrapolation of good news component, or just, you know, people willing to see, okay, this stock's up X, we're going to just chase it up X plus whatever. So all that is going on, I think, around the same time.
But I don't know if it, you know, we'd usually try to explain it from a short squeeze, right? But there's not a huge amount of, like Dell doesn't have a huge short position on it. It's you know, it had some, of course, but maybe that was going into the earnings. They could have flipped it overnight. People would have probably protected it with some options. But the fact is that they went up 30-something percent, which, by the way, they were great earnings, right? But I agree with you, this whole extrapolation, and we're going to use Dell as another example, and I want your opinion on this. So back in the day, way back in the other day, there was another Dell phenomena. The phenomena was Dell, before it was taken private, if you remember, it was the you know, for years, it was, you know, the poster child for success for computers, for computing, for personal computers. And what happened back then, if you recall, there was analysis done, an extrapolation done, just like you said, that it's going to go on forever. In fact, if you took it and you went to the extreme, everybody would have to have about 3 or 4 PCs on each of their desks to extrapolate out what they were predicting they would sell, which we realized was kind of like, that's stupid, right? Is that kind of what you're talking about? That whole idea that this continuation of what's going to happen is probably not possible?
Well, I mean, you know, here's the thing. This whole market right now is being driven by the amount of the billions of dollars being spent on AI and that build out. You know, to me, the biggest fragility is if Sundar Pichai or Satya Nadella or someone in that situation says, you know what, maybe we're going to slow down this spending a little bit. I don't want to see what happens as a result of that. But that, to me, is the single biggest point of fragility. But just thinking more broadly, you know, we've always had big market moves around the periods when new technologies were being adopted. And this is, you know, yes, we could think about the internet. Yeah, we could think about the mid-80s PC enthusiasm, which actually in some ways led to the conditions that was one of the things that led to the enthusiasm that eventually ended in a crash. But before that, right, there was the Nifty 50 phenomenon of the 70s, right, where you had, you know, all these great new technology companies like Polaroid and Kodak and Xerox, little theme here, that were going to just dominate the world forever. You go back to radios, RCA being the NVIDIA of its day.
Radio Shack.
Railroads. I mean, this happened. This is human nature. And we see this every few decades or so when there's this big technological achievement that I will stipulate is incredibly transformative and ultimately good for the economy and society. But we extrapolate too much good news into it. At the risk of overdoing, let's say, the internet, you know, example, you know, I'm going to rattle a few names at you here,
okay,
you know, because one of the things that we needed for the internet was a lot of bandwidth. And I will stipulate that bandwidth was necessary, that we're still using a lot of that bandwidth. And that the build out had to occur in a very rapid manner.
Mm-hmm.
So you had market leaders like Global Crossing, Northern Telecom, Lucent.
I got all the symbols coming up in my head as you're saying this, by the way.
WorldCom. I mean, they're all gone.
Yep.
I mean, I'm not saying that a lot of these internet companies will be gone. You know, I'm sorry that the AI companies will be gone, but we get these massive, you know, we misallocate capital sometimes at the peaks of these frenzies. And the question now is, are we closer to the, you know, are from internet bubble terms, are we in 1995 or 1999? And I will say, having been in a bull market for 3.5 years, that literally coincides with the introduction of ChatGPT, it's hard to say that we're in the early inning of this. And that's what makes some of these comparisons a little bit nerve-wracking, shall we say.
And the question is that there was also a stream of other companies that during that period, we didn't know who the winners and losers were, right? You know, and everybody was a winner until proven otherwise. You know, I will mention a couple of names just to throw in your basket of non-existence, like a Webvan and a Peapod, right? That's the same thing. And we have difficult to really figure out who that's going to be. Is ChatGPT going to be the number one? Is Perplexity, Claude, you know, or who knows what is going to be the number one? Or is any of these going to be just taken over, taken out, and by the wayside? Excellent, excellent points. But I think everybody's betting that everything stays and everybody is profitable and that the existence of these are morphing into something, whether it's going to be put into robots or utilized to create unmatched wealth for all of us by just sitting around and I don't know what we're going to do. Our agents that we program will just watch them stream money to us, I guess, or something. I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, there's a few elements in there. I rather than picking on, let's say, Webvan or, you know, or pets.com or something like that, that didn't make any money.
Right.
Let me stipulate that these companies are making money. And let me stipulate that I'm going to focus, you know, the ones I focused on, Nortel and Global Crossing and things like that, were phenomenally profitable at the time. They were.
Yeah.
They just, and so, you know, not to this degree, but again, these were profitable companies. But just to show you the example of how technology changes, at the, you know, 1998, 1999, I think the, you know, the basic model was that we were going to connect, you know, via the newfound bandwidth, which we did. Our portal was probably going to be AOL and our preferred search engine was going to be Yahoo. And we might still get our mail via CompuServe. These are the technology moves. There's, you know, as we sit here now, you know, ChatGPT got the whole theme of generative AI going, but it's not clear that they're even the leader now. It looks like they've probably been surpassed by Anthropic and Claude already. So these are very fast moving technologies. And let me also stipulate that, you know, that Google and Facebook did not exist during the internet bubble, yet they came essentially to dominate the internet later on. So I don't think most people had internet as advertising vehicle necessarily on their bingo cards for how this was going to be the profitable venture.
Right.
So the key was it took a long time for the benefits of the internet to reach the bottom lines of end users. And right now we're still seeing that build out, but it's not, everybody's trying to put AI to use. Companies understand it. We understand it certainly as a company.
But
you hear things like token maxing where companies might give a perverse incentive to programmers to use as much AI capacity to show that they're using it, but not necessarily using it well. Right. Or you take it down to its next extreme, which would be, okay, we can eliminate all these, you know, maybe junior coders or junior spreadsheet filler inners or legal brief writers. Because it's, you know, the AI can do a lot of that for us, which it probably can. And then we'll just have, you know, more experienced people, checking the output for errors. The problem is, if you don't have people who've done that, who's going to know to check it for errors? So in the short term, yeah, that works. In the longer term, what do you do? Right. I mean, you know, do you just have like, you know, legal bots trading other legal briefs with other bots,
right?
And nobody really to check the mistakes because you know, as a junior lawyer, you haven't been working 75 hours and having your boss yell at you because you misplaced a semicolon.
Yeah.
So these are things, you know, you learn from this scut work to some extent. And I think if we, you know, as a society, we're going to have to adapt to that. And this is part of the process. Any new technology brings change. That's okay. And we like that, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, automobiles put a lot of, you know, buggy whip manufacturers out of business.
Sure.
Are we worse off as a society? No.
No.
We need to adapt. But the period of adaptation is not always necessarily smooth sailing.
Sure. So I want to reel us back a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about your process. I want to talk about investing. I want to talk about something that you brought up and I read about and I thought fascinating, this ratchet process. And, you know, it's funny, the word ratchet has multiple meanings, right? For us more seasoned gents, ratchet means ratchet, right? The younger people, ratchet means disgusting, foul, and horrifying. I think they actually, somebody along the way misspelled it and thought wretched was ratchet. And that's where I think the genesis of that particular word. I've tried to explain this to a lot of people and say, you're looking stupid when you say this, but nonetheless. Every day, I want to talk about market behavior. I want to talk about investing. I want to talk about what you do. You sit down each day and you think about what's going on out there. What's kind of the first thing that you will look at?
I mean, the first thing I look at is basically, you know, turn on my Trader Workstation and some of the other apps that I use to check markets and see what's going on. I've got a watch list. I look at overnight. Basically, I look at the basics first. Overnight futures, you know, S&P, NQ. You know, now that VIX trades to a certain extent overnight, is there movement in the VIX? But more importantly, you know, 2 and 10 year yields to the extent they've changed overnight. Certainly, I'm looking at oil a lot more than I used to.
Right.
You know, and so that gets me the general tenor of what's going on. And, you know, or should I be concerned about too much, you know, based on some of these movements? You know, lately we've been getting some conflicting symbols, and that's where that ratchet effect comes into. But I'll get into that in a little bit. But to answer the question of what am I looking at, then I'll start to look at what's moving, what's making news, and you know, what stocks are making their moves, and then can I draw any patterns from that? And that's the part that's a little bit harder, you know. So, for example, you know, I recently wrote about patterns, you know, that last week, you know, the prior week to taping this, the S&P had its ninth straight up week, which, you know, that's talk about a pattern,
right?
And I went back to see, you know, how many weeks this year had been up. And we've had 22, at that point, we had 22 weeks of the year, 22 Fridays. 12 of those weeks had finished higher for the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning if you took out the 9 weeks in a row, we only had 3 up weeks for the S&P 500
mm-hmm.
prior to this. So it's a phenomenal change. And so then you have to think about, okay, what has changed and why? What is going on? What is underlying this? So to me, as someone looking at patterns, the typical patterns have been, if you have higher oil prices, particularly when they're at this level, if you have higher yields, generally that's not good for stocks.
Okay.
Right? I mean, you know, again, talk about the price of inputs and, of course, you know, fixed income being one of those inputs. And so then, you know, then what I would be doing is what's easily explainable and what's maybe a bit of cognitive dissonance. And that's what led me to the ratchet effect idea. Because, you know, what we've seen recently is, I've lost count as we're taping this, you know, first week in June, how many times since war broke out in the Persian Gulf that we've heard some sort of positive development about peace talks or the peace process or an extension of a ceasefire, et cetera, et cetera. to the best of my knowledge, we have one ceasefire. The rest of it is all, you know, negotiation. And 30,
by the way, I've counted 32. We've had 32 ceasefires, which, by the way, does not 32. Mean that we don't continue bombing, just to be clear.
Exactly. The ceasefires don't always mean that the firing has ceased, by the way. So, okay, so 32 ceasefire announcements, one of which actually has been a ceasefire.
Right.
The other 31 have been some sort of positive developments. And then when you throw in, you know, each time that you know, talks are progressing or everybody's doing well, blah, blah, blah. That part I've lost count of. So thank you for helping me with the ceasefire, with the ceasefire count. On each of those announcements, the stock market pretty reliably bounces.
Right.
And I think to some extent, some of the announcements, a cynic might say that some of the announcements are designed to make the market bounce, but I digress. Mm-hmm. But here's the difference. When those stocks, when a bona fide sounding announcement comes out, you have stocks rally, you have oil sell off, you have bond yields lower, right? That all makes sense,
yeah.
Right? You know, maybe we get oil through the straits, oil prices come down, inflationary pressures come down. And then of course, that's all good for stocks. When they don't come to fruition, we see oil start to drift higher and yields start to drift higher. Sometimes aggressively when it, you know, when there's actual missiles flying back and forth.
Right.
Stocks, on the other hand, they don't go down. So that's what I mean by the ratchet is, you know, if anybody who's ever used a socket wrench, it turns in one direction, tightens the bolt and nut and bolt, and then, you know, you swing it back, but it doesn't actually loosen it. That's the beauty of it. And you said, it's funny you said this, having to explain the term. I used the term, a reporter out of Japan, a young woman read the report and she had basically, could you explain to me what the term means? So right. I had to found like Japanese Wikipedia,
yeah.
But, you know, it doesn't translate well. And especially if you think in terms of, you know, internet slang, it doesn't translate well either,
right.
But anyone who's ever used a tool should understand, you know, that, you know, a socket wrench should understand that idea where you have, where you move in one direction and then you don't move back in the other. And to me, that is another sign of the unrelentingly positive sentiment. And basically the mentality that, you know, all news is good news unless absolutely proven otherwise right now. And so the good news is taken as good news. The bad news is, or the lack thereof is simply ignored and we move on to something else. So, you know, we move sideways rather than down, at worst. And you know, again, going back to the generational idea, younger investors understandably have really come to see every dip as a buying opportunity.
Right. That's what I was getting at from the, if we kind of flip back the page for just a second,
sure.
All those things we talked about, you mentioned 82 and 87 and 2000, 2008, all those, you know, all those different things, the Volmageddon, all those things have been technically, if you think about it, because we're at an all-time highs or close to a buying opportunity, right? I mean, obviously that's what it says. Is that the training that we have that is so ingrained in this generation where I think before the internet was there and the daily information was available and all that, there was a lot more skepticism in stocks. I could think back to people back in the 80s and 90s talking about the 70s. You know, oh man, the 70s, oh my God, it was horrible. And even in 2000, for a period, there was people like, you know what, you know, you see what happens. You could drop by 90% for an index or for a stock. But because there has been that put that has been put upon things back in, you know, many years ago, and the Fed really, since Bernanke, their desire to use the communication tool, by the way, which is, in my opinion, nothing more than a Pied Piper, right? Just to kind of make sure that they are, and they tell you that they're leading the markets. They want to tell the markets where they're going. That's what they tell you. It's not a secret, by the way. They're saying that the communication.
It's much cheaper to do it. It's much cheaper to do it with words than with actions, right? You don't have to do anything if you do it with words.
Right. Until, let's maybe, you tell me I'm wrong about this, till it doesn't work anymore. And all of a sudden, where the connections don't work and the believability is bare, where transitory became a terrible word, which, by the way, was picked up recently by Besant, as you may have seen. He was talking about inflation being transitory again. I'm like, oh, no, don't say that. Don't say that. Use your thesaurus to come up with a different word, will you please? But are we so trained and are we so do we have such a lack of any concern that that's the way it is and that's the way it's going to be? And the answer probably is yes right now, but what are your thoughts about this on a long-term basis?
Well, you know, your point is a good one about everything being a buying opportunity to some extent, right? If you have an infinite amount of money and an infinite time horizon, sure, everything's been a buying opportunity.
Right?
I mean, we're at all-time highs, therefore every time it's been lower has been a time to buy, including yesterday, right?
Yesterday,
I mean,
so, day before, last week, last month, everybody. Yeah, exactly.
Right. The problem being, we don't all have infinite amounts of money and infinite time horizons.
Yeah.
Right. We just don't. So, you know, if you're thinking about retirement, how much of a drawdown can you afford before you have to start changing your lifestyle? If you're about to if you have kids that you have to put to college, how much of a drawdown can you deal with in your 529 or the kids 529 or your other savings plans before it hurts and you have to really consider whether that's feasible. If you're trying to buy a house and you've been saving up for a down payment, how much of that are you willing to risk at any given point?
Can I interrupt? That's a fascinating one right there, because I remember, I want to say two other times, I don't know if I'm counting this right, but two other times in my career that people have said, you know what, I'm going to buy a house in about a year or so there's plenty of time to put in the stock market and make it grow. And I'm like, I don't know, maybe I got the wrong manual to how this all works, but somehow that's not right. I mean, but we're here again now.
Oh, and I think right now there's a certain amount of what I would call financial nihilism among younger investors. Number one, if you're under 40, pretty much you don't remember a period of a sustained downturn, right? Because the last real sustained downturn was 2007 to 2009. So that you were, most 40-year-olds weren't in the markets,
sure,
then, right? I mean,
yeah.
So they don't have that experience. Since then, we've had bear markets, but they've tended to be short and shallow. We pretty much went through the decade of the tens with almost no hiccups because of very low inflation and a whole series of, you know.
I think the VIX got down. What was the VIX down to, like under 10 or something at that point?
2000, just before Volmageddon, which you referred to, in 2018, VIX was down, about 10. And I remember people trying to credibly tell me that it's a sale at 10. I'm like, you're betting against human nature. But by the way, the Fed didn't really intervene in that one because that was a stock market alone phenomenon. They did intervene on the other hand, in 2019, which was not a stock market phenomenon, when repo markets tended to lock up, which is why we had a huge financial run-up even into January and February of 2020, as we started to get these reports that there was this virus that might actually shut down the world. But it took stocks a while to notice because the momentum was so strong. But that was one situation where the Fed did not intervene because it didn't affect the rest of the markets. And a situation where it did intervene that had nothing to do with stocks because if the repo markets locked up, you know, there'd be a banking crisis and we don't want to deal with that. I understand why they did it. That's not a fault, but this is why, again, you have to watch if the central banks are doing stuff. So then there was the COVID bear market, but the monetary and fiscal response was so enormous that it became a very short-lived financial event. And then, of course, in 2020, later into 2021, it became a bit of a mania, which, when the Fed started raising rates in 2022, we did have a bit of a bear market. I guess we did have a bit of a bear market in 2018 after Volmageddon because things had gotten overheated, which, coincidentally, the only two bear markets in, let's say, the last 15 years were in midterm election years, of which we're in now. But I wouldn't say we're off on that. We looked like we were off there. And we came close to a bear market in April 25 last year, after the Liberation Day tantrum. But that was in many ways an unforced error. And so, we're able to reverse course. So to the extent that we've had any downtrends, no. Any newer investor, it hasn't lasted. Monetary policy or fiscal policy has changed to fix it. So you have this scenario where, number one, you're nervous about the effect of AI or other, societal changes on your ability to have the sort of lifestyle that your parents had, meaning buy a house, get married, et cetera, all those kind of major financial considerations.
Right.
While at the same time, you've got this seemingly foolproof money machine that you could just put your money into, it's stocks, and it goes up. And so, that'll solve the stock market. Will solve my problems.
All my problems.
So that's where I do think this financial, there's a degree of financial nihilism among younger investors. And that scares me as the parent of two of them.
Yes.
Because, I do worry that, they and their peers, get a harsh awakening at some point. And the longer it goes on without that reminder, the harder it gets to deal with it.
So here's a question I just thought of, and this is a bit of a left turn on this, but I just thought of something. What's worse, the nihilism or conservatism? In other words, you have young people that are like, okay, I'm going to put it in the stock market and let it rip and I don't care. Or the young person's like, I'm so afraid, I don't want to do anything. Because I can tell you in the end, all things being equal, assuming there's not some kind of a cataclysmic, financial meltdown or something, the person who has money in the stock market is going to probably, we cannot guarantee and all that other good stuff. Put that aside for a second. But I see people that have for years not put any money in the markets and not put money in bonds, not doing anything. They stick it in low interest rate annuities. They are in bad shape now.
They're both wrong. Extremes are wrong.
That's a good point. I didn't think about that option.
Right? Right now, risk taking is being rewarded, and since there hasn't been punished at all, you need sort of the balance of risk and reward to equilibrate at some point.
Right.
But being too conservative is problematic too, right? I mean, particularly if it's a younger investor, you've got a 30-40 year time horizon until you're likely to retire. Put your money to work for you.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be sitting in. Yes, if you've got specific needs, you need to put aside relatively conservative amounts for those needs. Again, colleges, down payments, et cetera, et cetera. Don't go gambling with that sort of stuff.
Sure.
But in general, yeah, this is the same, for the same reason I would say, eat a balanced diet, work out. These are just, don't be overly conservative. Don't be overly risk-taking. I think the right answer is somewhere in the middle. It's a little tough right now because the extreme risk-takers are the ones who are getting extreme rewards. Right. And I think when you lose sight of, when the equation isn't risk versus reward, but risk equals reward, I think that's when you get into some issues.
Just a couple more things here, because you talked about we talked a little bit about this ratchet effect, which is fascinating, and the idea of where we are. But I think what you're saying, if I could say it a little bit differently and tell me if you agree, is that is the hallmark of a very bullish trend, very bullish market of high investor sentiment. Even with the backdrop of lousy consumer sentiment and wars and oil price. I want to talk about oil for a second too. But all of that is actually, from a market strategist standpoint, from an investor standpoint, from an advisor standpoint, I shouldn't ignore that and try to overlay all the potential negatives that could happen, should I?
No, I mean, you have to be cognizant. As far as I'm concerned, the biggest risk you can do is ignore risk. The biggest risk you can take is to ignore it. It's always there. And in many cases, it's at its worst when you don't think it's there. We've alluded to the Volmageddon argument before. The reason that the VIX was at 9 or 10 was because people didn't perceive there was any risk.
Right.
Boom. Risk comes back and bites you in the rear end at the
risk
absolute.
Risk happens fast, right?
Risk happens fast.
Yeah.
Here's a little other equation. It's prices are set at the margin. So, you think that, it's nice that you can, invest, you know, it's nice that these companies are building up huge amounts of market cap. But for example, you know, if considering the share, you know, some of the share moves, you know, if I sell 100 shares of stock and it moves Apple by 7 cents, because I did it, you know, in the middle of the night or something, I've just taken $1 billion off of their market cap. I think the number, maybe it's 700 shares, some small amount, but yeah, basically you can, you know, the numbers that are being thrown around are so huge. And so this to me is the big issue is the worst accidents happen when risk gets completely tossed aside. 1987, we were never going down again. Nobody wanted to own bonds. On the training class at Salomon Brothers, bond market was the most, bond floor, which was always the profit engine of that firm, was the most depressing place to be because bonds didn't have an uptick for like 6 months because, you know, because all the money was flowing into stocks because there was no risk in stocks.
Yep.
And of course you could buy portfolio insurance, which would minimize your risk, which of course exacerbated it, but that's a topic for another podcast. We could do an hour on that. But anyway, you know, subprime mortgages. Oh, you know, there's no risk in lending to, there's, you know, sure, mortgages always get paid back. Don't worry about it. There's no risk in lending mortgages. What could go wrong? You know, if we package these things and give them a AAA rating and they're never going to default and there won't be any repercussions. These are when the accidents happen. Or there's such faith in some new development like the internet that's going to so transform the economy that we only focus on the reward and not the risk. That's when we always get into the most trouble, is when we lose that balance. The risk and reward, it's a yin and a yang. They need to be, I don't want to get Eastern philosophical on us because that's not my thing by any means. But they always have to have a balance. There's got to be a reasonable push-pull.
All right, in closing, we talked about rats, we talked about VIX issues, we talked about all this, we talked about the whether it's complacency or bullishness, either one is, the fact is that the ratchet kind of explains that, which I think is a great visual to have. We talked about some of the things that you do on a regular basis to look at and what's happening with intermarket relationships. I want to try to do a rapid fire with you real quick. I got a few different things under 5 words real quick in closing some of this. Okay. So here we go. You ready? Under 5 words or so. You can do it more if you want. Most overrated indicator.
Dow Jones.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. That was only two, so you could bank three. Most underrated indicator?
Equal weight S&P.
Oh, that's so right. You know what? I was thinking myself. I'm trying to answer these questions myself as you go along. Perfectly answered, I think, because that's a really good point, by the way, because I have been, this is a topic for another show too, but I have been, my listeners know this, scratching my head for the last few years about market cap weighting and where does it go. And by the way, just a few days ago, NVIDIA was down like 4%. That was 35 basis points off of the SPX.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, that's dumb. I remember when the Brazilian market was dominated by Petrobras. I don't know if you remember that, about like 40% the Brazilian ETF was like Petrobras. I'm like, I want to be in Brazil. I am not investing 40% in Petrobras. Just not happening. Anyway.
Well, just so you know, this is going to be more than 5 words, but if you're investing in the S&P 500 right now, you're 40% invested in AI. And don't even get me started on South Korea, which is two stocks.
Two stocks. So. You got SK Hynix and you got Samsung. That's it. 40%.
Yeah. Even here in the US, if you want to buy a nice conservative S&P 500 mutual fund, index fund, you're 40% or more invested in AI at this point.
The bullish people would say, that's a great thing. I love it. Let's get more, right? The more people that want to diversify, like what? You know, diversification has become really hard because even in our international exposures, there's a heavy weighting in some of these areas because of the market cap weighting of it. And in fact, the South Korea market just took over a variety of other markets because they're up just a mere, 225% in the last year or something like that. Just something like that. All right, here we go. Under five, bullish or cautious right now?
Cautious.
Cautious right now. One chart, everybody.
Let me give you the Buffett answer.
Okay.
Be fearful when others are greedy and be greedy when others are fearful.
Yep.
There's a lot of greedy people out there.
A lot of greedy. One chart everybody should be watching.
S&P, the S&P advanced declines because they're not confirming the S&P 500 right now.
And that's because the narrowing nature of the market focusing in on just a few stocks primarily. I would assume that, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And why the RSP or the S&P 500 equal weight is not up as much as the, let's just say the NASDAQ 100 or the S&P itself, I guess is the point. All right, last one. Biggest misconceptions about today's markets or today's market, maybe.
That they can never go down.
Ah, you have good. I just want to say that I didn't give these questions out beforehand, but you give like answers that I think are spot on. So that's great. That is awesome. That is awesome. Hey, I appreciate you coming on the show and giving us your knowledge. Steve Sosnick, he's the chief strategist at Interactive Brokers, also known as IBKR. So thanks, Steve, for joining us. There you go.
My pleasure, Andrew. Thank you so much. I hope we get a chance to do this again. All right, take care.
Great. And seriously, those answers he gave on those quick under 5-word answers, those were great. Those are perfect. Play that back. Rewind. Play it back, listen to it, and I think that will give us a lot of great insights right there. Thanks to Steve for that. Listen, thanks for you being here. Thank you for, hey, by the way, we have been publishing a lot of more video clips and shorties on both LinkedIn and on Twitter, and I think we're going to actually, we may get a TikTok channel or Instagram, I'm not sure, but a lot of the little snippets from the shows have been playing on there, so make sure to go over, if nothing else, to X or Twitter. My name, Andrew Horowitz, in one word, is the place. You can see what's going on there and get a visual on what's going on as well. But of course, you can also listen on places like Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, and anywhere else that you find great podcasts. We will be there. Thanks for joining me this week and every week. And enjoy the start of June and the start of summer. I'll see you real soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS.